1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Andrew Smith and Katie Weaver. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Andrew Smith.
Large fields of water lilies will grow in a New York City neighborhood this autumn, at least digitally. A very large show celebrating French painter Claude Monet will open in November in a building once used as a bank in the Wall Street area. The name of the show is Monet's Garden, The Immersive Experience. The Immersive Experience uses digital technology to show very large images of Monet's paintings on the walls and floors of the building. It has music, the smell of lavender, and voiceover in several languages to help visitors immerse in the experience. Dr. Nepomuk Schessel is the producer of the exhibition. He said, "To be able to address more than just two senses, I think, will immerse people a bit more." Monet lived from 1840 until 1926. During his life, Monet changed from painting traditional, realistic images to capturing light, atmosphere, and movement. Schessel explained that Monet was living right at the moment when photography was invented. So, the whole world of art changed. The show will offer many of Monet's works, from the rocky coastline of Normandy to the Japanese bridge and water lilies at his home in Giverny. Swiss Creative Lab Immersive Art AG developed the idea for the show, along with Allegria Concert GmbH. It has already been shown in some European cities and will be shown in London. In some ways, Schessel thinks a huge 360-degree presentation of Monet's works fits with what Monet wanted. He wanted the spectator to completely immerse himself or herself into the painting, said Schessel. Last year, two other immersive shows of the Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh came to New York City, and the exhibit of Austrian artist Gustav Klimt also used similar technology. Schessel says he looks at these kinds of exhibits to make sure his team knows about the newest technologies and ways of making immersive experiences possible. But he said the paintings should always be the center. The technology is our means to achieve something, but it never should only be the technology, he said. I'm Andrew Smith.
Thank you.
new show at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London explores South Korean popular culture and its rise to international fame. Among the things to see at Hallyu, the Korean Wave, are K-pop costumes, K-drama props, as well as a copy of a set from the Academy Award-winning film Parasite. Rosalie Kim is the curator or organizer of the show. She told Reuters news agency that the exhibition celebrates the colorful popular culture of South Korea from its beginnings to its place on the international stage. Hallyu means Korean wave, and it refers to this rise of popular culture from South Korea that has taken the world by storm in the past few decades, Kim said. The exhibition is divided into parts, including K-pop and its fans, television drama and film, as well as fashion and beauty. The pink clothing that singer Psy wore in the music video for his 2012 hit Gangnam Style welcomes visitors to the exhibition. Other clothing on show includes colorful designer creations, as well as costumes worn by G-Dragon and K-pop groups At Ease and aespa. From the world of television, there are costumes from historical dramas, as well as clothing from Squid Game. The Victoria and Albert Museum worked closely with the production designer of Parasite, Lee Ha-joon, to reproduce his set. Other objects to see include pictures, music album covers, and long signs called banners that were made by K-pop fans. Visitors can also take part in a K-pop dance competition. Hallyu, the Korean Wave, opened Saturday and runs until June. I'm Katie Weaver.
Next is this week's Science Report with Brian Lin. He tells us how the American Space Agency NASA recorded vibrations and sounds of space rocks striking the planet Mars. Listen closely to the story. After we hear from Brian, there will be a question for you to answer to test your understanding of the report. Now, here is Brian Lin.
Researchers say a spacecraft on Mars has recorded vibrations and sounds of space rocks hitting the planet. The activity was picked up by a seismometer, an instrument that measures ground noises and shaking linked to earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and explosions. The seismometer sits on the surface of Mars. It is connected to the InSight lander, which is operated by the American Space Agency, NASA. Scientists recently announced the instrument had discovered seismic waves from four different space rocks that crashed into Mars in 2020 and 2021. The first of the four confirmed meteoroids entered Mars' atmosphere on September 5, 2021, NASA said in a statement. Meteoroid is the term used for a space rock before it hits the ground. Once the rock or parts of it hit the surface, they are called meteorites. The first rock to enter the atmosphere exploded into at least three pieces. Each of the pieces left craters on the surface. Researchers then estimated where the craters were. NASA even released recordings of what the meteoroid strikes sounded like. Later, the team used NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to confirm the crater positions. The orbiter's imaging instruments found three darkened spots on the surface. InSight's seismometer has already discovered numerous Mars quakes on the red planet. A Mars quake is a seismic event on Mars that is similar to earthquakes that happen on Earth. But NASA said this was the first time scientists were able to confirm that these kinds of seismic and sound waves were linked to space rock strikes. The discovery also marks the first time that such seismic activity from strikes, also called impacts, has been measured on Mars. Researchers recently published details on their findings in a paper in the publication Nature Geoscience. Ingrid Daubar is a specialist on Mars impacts at Brown University in Rhode Island. She was a co-writer of the paper. Daubar said in a statement, "After 3 years of InSight waiting to detect an impact, those craters looked beautiful." NASA said the team used earlier data to also confirm three other impacts. One happened in May 2020, another in February 2021, and a third in August 2021. Researchers have wondered why they have not detected more meteoroid strikes on Mars. After all, the planet sits next to the solar system's main asteroid belt, which produces a large number of flying space rocks. In addition, the Mars atmosphere is just 1% as thick as Earth's, meaning more meteoroids can pass through it without being destroyed. Daubar said that on Mars, hundreds of impact craters are forming somewhere on the planet's surface every year. But NASA scientists say InSight Lander's seismometer may have been missing impacts because of interfering noise from the Martian wind or seasonal changes in the atmosphere. The researchers believe the new findings could lead to many new impact discoveries based on InSight's existing data that goes back to 2018, when the lander arrived on Mars. Scientists say the study of seismic activity on Mars can help them better understand the materials contained below the planet's surface. "Impacts are the clocks of the solar system," said Rafael Garcia, a lead writer of the paper and a scientist at France's Higher Institute of Aeronautics and Space in Toulouse. "We need to know the impact rate today to estimate the age of different surfaces," he said in a statement. Garcia added that the same kind of instrument might also be used to make similar measurements on the moon. He said two French-built seismometers are expected to be included in a NASA lunar science mission that could launch in 2025. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, here is a question for you. What did the scientists say they hope to learn from the continued study of seismic activity on Mars? Is it A. About possible volcanic activity inside Mars. B. About materials contained below the planet's surface. Or C. About the kinds of climate that can cause Mars quakes. The answer is B. Let's listen to that part again.
Scientists say the study of seismic activity on Mars can help them better understand the materials contained below the planet's surface.
To answer more questions about Brian's report, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we talked about the debate at the convention over the Virginia Plan. The plan was prepared by James Madison and other delegates from the state of Virginia. It described a national government with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Some delegates feared that such a central government would take away power from the states. But in the end, they approved the proposal. On June 1st, they began debate on the issue of a national executive. It seemed every delegate at the Philadelphia Convention had something to say about the issue. They had been thinking about it for some time. Almost every delegate was afraid to give the position extended powers. Almost no one wanted America's chief executive to become as powerful as a king. Still, many of the delegates had faith in the idea of a one-person executive. Others demanded an executive of three people. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued for a single executive. He said the position required energy and the ability to make decisions quickly. He said these would best be found in one person. Edmund Randolph of Virginia disagreed strongly. He said he considered a one-person executive as the fetus of monarchy. John Dickinson of Delaware said he did not denounce the idea of having a government headed by a king. He said a monarchy was one of the best forms of government in the world. However, in America, he said, a king was out of the question. The debate over the size of the executive leadership lasted a long time. Finally, the delegates voted for a one-person executive. The question of how to limit power was a major part of the delegates' conversation, according to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
We're still talking about what are the limits of the national government? What is the role of the national government? How do we protect individual rights and individual liberties, etc.?
And he says that question continues to be asked in America today. During the debate at the convention, other questions about the national executive arose. One question was the executive's term. Should the executive serve just once or could that person be re-elected? Alexander Hamilton argued for a long term of office. He said, if a president served only a year or two, America soon would have many former presidents. These former presidents, he said, would fight for power, and that would be bad for the peace of the nation. Benjamin Franklin argued for the right of re-election. The people, he said, were the rulers of a republic, and presidents were the servants of the people. If the people wanted to elect the same president again and again, they had the right to do this. In the final document, the president's term was set at 4 years, with re-election permitted. Next came the question of how to choose the president. It was a most difficult problem. The delegates debated and voted, and then re-debated and re-voted on a number of proposals. James Wilson proposed that the executive be elected by special representatives of the people called electors. Several delegates disagreed. They said the plan would be too difficult to carry out and would cost too much money. One delegate proposed that the president be elected by the state governors. He said the governors of large states would have more votes than the governors of small states. Nobody liked this proposal, especially delegates from the small states. Another proposal was to have the president elected directly by the people. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was shocked by this idea. The people do not understand these things, he said. A few dishonest men can easily fool the people. The worst way to choose a president, he said, would be to have him elected by the people. The convention voted on the issue 60 times. In the end, the delegates agreed that the president should be chosen by electors named by state legislatures. Now someone said, we have decided how to choose the president, but what are we to do if he does bad things after being chosen? We should have some way of dismissing that person. Yes, the delegates agreed, it should be possible to try the president, and if he is found guilty, remove him from office. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania spoke in support of the right of impeachment should the president be persuaded to betray his trust. The delegates approved a proposal for removing a president found guilty of bribery, treason, or other high crimes. The last major question about executive authority was the question of veto power over the national legislature. Not one delegate was willing to give the president complete power to reject new laws, and yet they felt he should have some voice in the lawmaking process. If this were not done, they said, the office of president would have little meaning, and the national legislature would have the power of a dictator. James Madison offered a solution. The president should have the power to veto a law, Madison said, but his veto could be overturned if most of the members of the legislature voted to pass the law again. The final convention document listed more details about the office. For example, It said the president had to be a natural-born citizen of the United States or a citizen at the time the Constitution was adopted. The president must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years and be at least 35 years old. The executive would be paid, but the pay could not be increased or reduced during the term in office. The president would be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and, from time to time, report to the legislature on the State of the Union. The final document also gave the words by which a president would be sworn in. Every 4 years, for more than 200 years now, each president has repeated this oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Another major issue debated by the convention was a national judiciary, a federal system of courts and judges. The delegates knew a lot about the issue. 34 of them were lawyers. 8 were judges in their home states. One question hung heavy in the air. The states had their own courts and judges. Did the national government need its own system too? Several delegates said no. Roger Sherman of Connecticut said existing state courts were enough. Besides, he said, a system of national courts would be too costly. John Rutledge of South Carolina opposed a national system of lower courts, but he argued for a Supreme Court. Eventually, the convention voted for both. There would be a Supreme Court and a system of lower courts. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the United States. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. The next question concerned the appointment of national judges. Some delegates believed judges should be appointed by the legislature. Others believed they should be appointed by the president. James Wilson argued in support of having one person appoint judges. He said experience showed that large bodies could not make appointments fairly or openly. John Rutledge disagreed strongly. By no means, he said, should the president appoint judges. He said that method looked too much like monarchy. Benjamin Franklin then told a funny little story. In Scotland, he said, he understood that judges were appointed by lawyers. They always chose the very best lawyer to be a judge. Then they divided that person's cases among themselves. The delegates voted on the issue. They agreed that the legislature could decide how many judges would sit on the Supreme Court. The president would appoint the judges. The legislature could establish lower courts from time to time. The president would appoint those judges too. The issues involving the executive and the federal courts were serious questions that most delegates felt strongly about. But the most hotly debated issue of the convention was still to come.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.